When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
It's The Wonky Show. A merger between two major universities is what's on everyone's lips this week, and we'll be digesting all the implications for the sector, staff, students involved, and a local region. Plus, we're discussing the recent reshuffle in Westminster and what it means for the sector. It's all coming up.
Look, we don't really know whether the inclination of Number 10 not to tinker too much with the education brief symbolises a lack of interest, or perhaps a sense that they're really, really compelled by the detailed plans that are developing in the run-up to the HE reform paper that's due in the coming months. And nobody quite knows what we learn from this.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Beach, and joining me to review the week in HE policy, we have three fantastic guests as always. In Milton Keynes, it's Ben Villiamy, Executive Director of the Association of Heads of Universities Administration. That's a hooah to you and me. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, apart from being in Milton Keynes, was meeting representatives from a dozen different universities to try and sign off a working model of an organisational efficiency maturity assessment. I get all the exciting projects, and it's a really exciting collaborative development that we're working on.
Lovely. And in Biggleswade, it's Emma Maslin, Senior Policy Research Officer at Amoshi. Emma, your highlight of the week, please.
So my highlight of the week is planning my trip to Glasgow next month to visit some of our Amoshi Scotland members in person, and also to the best donut shop I've ever visited.
And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's News Editor. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, everyone. I think the best thing I've done this week was I went and flew a kite. And it's made me ask why have I not been flying more kites over the last, you know, 3 decades since I last flew one.
Right. Now, so speaking of kite flying, we start the week with a merger of two universities. Michael, what on earth is going on?
The University of Greenwich and the University of Kent have unveiled plans to basically join together to merge. They're going to unite forces as the London and South East University Group, although that name is still sort of, you know, subject to confirmation, subject to approval. But yeah, enormous. It's been talked about for such a long time. It is a new kind of model of bringing universities together, as I say, into a sort of group. We have had mergers over the past few years and further back, but, you know, typically that's been sort of forming one single new university. I mean, especially if you think about, say, City St. George's, which is the most recent example. You know, what's going to happen here is that they're going to keep the two brands together. So, you know, at least to begin with, from a student-facing side, it's going to be quite similar. You'll apply separately. Courses will be separate. You'll graduate separately. You know, but, you know, in sort of legal terms and in staff terms, they're going to be coming together as a legal entity, one single thing. It's already been decided there's going to be one senior management team, one governing body, and they've even managed to sort out who the first vice chancellor is going to be. You know, what was the problem? It's going to be Greenwich's Jane Harrington. Yeah, so it's a real surprise, but at the same time, not a surprise. I mean, this sort of idea of forms of, you know, radical collaboration being needed, given the government's not helping and the sector's finances are just, you know, in such a perilous state. You know, it's been talked about, these sort of, you know, new forms of universities forming groups. And yeah, they're trying to make quite quick progress with it. The hope, but, you know, the intention is that contracts will be exchanged by Christmas and that this new structure will be in place formally by the start of next academic year, which will leave us with, as they sort of said in their press release and tried to, you know, stress, is going to be one of the largest higher education institutions in the UK. It's going to be, you know, around the size of the University of Manchester, which, you know, I think we all sort of see as the enormous, enormous university. So it is really quite a massive development. And yet at the same time, you know, we should stress lots of the details are still emerging. Lots of the details haven't actually been confirmed yet and are still sort of subject to negotiation. But yeah, it's a big news, obviously enormous for the two universities and the staff there, but also, you know, for the sector as a whole.
Yeah. Right. We're going to dive into all of the different implications and sort of let's take it one by one. I want to start with you, Ben. why do you think this is happening now? We've been talking about university mergers and groups of universities for years. A lot of that's heated up a lot behind the scenes, but nothing's actually come about. Why these universities and why now?
Well, the why now is that there's a clear, you know, need for change. We know that the sector is creaking at the seams in some respects, and needs to think about how it can change form and shape in order to have some sustainability. And in the terms of the why now, well, I mean, I totally agree with this kind of assessment that it's massive news and not that massive, radical but not that radical, and new but not that new. In that, actually, you know, when you look at what's been going on in schools and colleges, multi-academy trusts, et cetera, this is kind of a model that's existed for quite a while. And I'm not saying it's the only model that the sector might change. I forecast that over the coming years, there'll be slightly different models of merger and collaboration and partnership. But this is a fairly tried and tested model. And funnily enough, a year ago, almost to the day, I just started at AHUA and I was hosting my first AHUA conference. And I specifically recall that we invited along someone called Janet Smith. Janet Smith is the principal and chief executive of Nottingham College. And we invited her along to talk about kind of, I suppose, the massification of further education as a response to their own periods of austerity and financial pressure. And she was fascinating. And she didn't necessarily say this is the model that should apply to universities. She wasn't claiming that at all. She was just saying, this is the model we've got. These are some of the pros of it. These are some of the cons of it. These are some of the lessons that AHUA members might want to reflect on. And actually, one of the most helpful lessons I remember her sharing from her experience of both being part of merger processes and subsequently being the chief exec and principal for one of the largest colleges in the UK with kind of huge complex estates and multidisciplined and very diverse student, you know, in many respects, you know, it's got some similar characteristics to a university. But one of the most interesting lessons I remember she left with us that I think others would be wise to think about is that the rationale and process for this type of partnership, yes, there needs to be an economic rationale, but actually the economic rationale, in order to deliver the best results, has to be married to an understanding of the needs and the identities of local communities. So kind of respecting that history and that heritage and the diversity of what comes together to make a new whole has to be, you know, as important as the economic argument.
That's right. I think, Emma, if you're working in one of those universities and, you know, this news lands in your inbox on a Wednesday morning out of nowhere, what's going to be going through your mind?
So I think in answer to that, I think I'm going to build on what Ben's just said about multi-academy trusts. Now, I think this has been a really interesting comparison because, so my first job was at a school in a multi-academy trust. And at the time, the school had, I think, just been kind of taken over, and the school kept its name. It had the same teachers as before, the same students, the same kind of, imagine the air quotes here, like experience as before. And so it was kind of billed as just business as usual. Then things started to change. So first it was that I had to redo all my display boards. So it had the same purple back paper and wavy border that you often get in these school settings. And that's quite minor. Then it started to govern kind of the outreach role I was doing, the activities I could or couldn't take students out for. And eventually my role was actually removed because it didn't match the governance structure that they wanted, reflecting across all the schools they managed. So in answer to your point about what that might look like for staff, I think there's a lot that's unknown right now, as kind of Michael's introduced at the start. And I think it would be naive not to anticipate that staffs and students who are going to be impacted by the merger will be anticipating some of those changes I've described. So that slow creeping of governance changes that eventually will lead to perhaps changes in job descriptions, roles, academic courses, and actually in some cases, maybe the existence of staff jobs. So I think lots of people will be jumping to thinking about what that end result might mean, particularly for things like staff jobs. And I think, you know, we can't underestimate the impact that kind of anticipated change might have on staff and students, because I think nervousness around students and what it might mean for them is likely to then impact, you know, our Amoshi members and student services, because that's where people turn to when there's concern, or, you know, they're the ones supporting students through difficult times. And so any uneasiness that the student body feels as this merger progresses is naturally going to impact staff, which is going to be tricky again if staff themselves are feeling really uneasy about what it might mean for them and their jobs. So I think key then thinking forwards about what might be done to kind of mitigate any of that is communication and communicating with staff on what the changes might mean for them, implementation timelines for students, working with student unions, inviting students to the table in these discussions. And when we're thinking about working with students as well, not assuming that this homogenous group, because for starters, we've got two distinct student bodies here. So ensuring both groups are, you know, consulted in a way that's meaningful rather than just as a way to kind of tick that student engagement box is going to be key here.
Michael, we've seen the government already pleased that this is happening. Clearly, there's been warm words put out from DfE, and we know that they want to incentivize this kind of collaboration. And, you know, if it all works, you can expect to hear a lot more from them about this. But what would you say are kind of the measures of success for a merger like this on its own terms? So, I mean, there's what the politicians like, and then there's the realities of this. When we look back at this in a decade, what do you think are going to be some of the things that we look at to say, yeah, this worked or it didn't work?
Well, I think, I mean, this perhaps isn't a measure of success exactly, but I think one really interesting thing is the extent to which this sort of group identity really solidifies. I mean, you know, I think there's different directions you could take it in. If in a decade, you know, students are still applying to courses at Greenwich or at Kent, you know, certainly in the medium term, the intention is they still will be. And I would have thought so, because both are, you know, fantastic universities, very good reputations. You know, they sort of established links with, you know, both overseas and of course at home. You know, I think certainly coming back more to sort of success, I think they will want to have found ways where they can show that the merger has, you know, in some areas made savings. I mean, it originally, you know, immediately the thing people latch onto is, you know, looking at things like, you know, there's just going to be one vice chancellor, one senior management team. But that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be fewer senior staff. It's going to be a very complex organization longer term, a larger organization longer term. You know, I think a really important thing, and probably a real reason why they're going for this, is around their sort of their clout, essentially, as, you know, as a large, powerful university group. You know, they will now be in a position to strengthen and deepen links with local areas, with, you know, forthcoming mayoral authorities in this area, with sort of local skills partnership with employers. You know, if they can really feel that there's been a significant sort of scaling up in you know, the weight they have to heft around in their region, you know, and politically and in terms of the influence they can make, I mean, that certainly will be one thing they'll be looking at. Yeah, but I mean, obviously it does come back to cost. If the university, you know, and whether this is to do with a merger or not, but, you know, or just the existing financial pressures in the statement, if they do run into sort of serious financial trouble, then that, as you've sort of hinted at, that does really cause issues for the government, who are pinning their hopes on this kind of thing, you know, being a way around some of the, you know, the hard choices that they seem quite unwilling to take.
There's something about, you know, the measure of success has to be about the delivery of the core function business of the institution. So, you know, this should be a vehicle that continues to deliver increasingly fantastic research, learning and teaching. And if it can show exactly that, that would be a great thing. And one of the things that goes through my mind, so yesterday I was listening to an extended interview with Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web. And he was, you know, this is a kind of fairly recently recorded interview. And he was acknowledging some of the problems that he created, that, you know, he talked about kind of the damage of the internet to democracies, and how it was kind of used to spread misinformation and to manipulate and to grow power inequities. And, you know, he acknowledged it very calmly, actually. But he also talks about the kind of the founding mission of his idea, which was about, like, massification of data, connecting more people together across all different cultures and diversities than ever before, so that the data could be cross-referenced, the opinions could have a greater breadth, you know, that there'd be all this rich research and learning that was going to be enabled by his invention. And importantly, he wasn't designing it to make himself money. He wasn't designing it to be Elon Musk or anything else. He was gifting it to the world. And so while I know there's plenty of people, sometimes myself included, who would kind of curse the invention of the World Wide Web, we also know it was created to enable great quality learning, teaching and research. And it's clearly played a role in that. And now the challenge is to kind of work on all the bits that are less comfortable. And it'll be the same exact, I suspect, for this merger, that there'll be some things that don't work and need to be addressed and thought about, and new processes and policies and procedures and practices have to be established in order to avoid detriment to people and communities and places. But if they can really be focused on delivering fantastic research, learning and teaching, they'll do well from this.
And I mean, I guess it feels like the start of something, doesn't it? Because even either the group itself or from a sector point of view, the amount of conversations that have been going on the last few years about mergers and exploring these kind of these sorts of different structures, clearly Greenwich and Kent, you know, are going to be kind of the first mover in this context anyway, and for these reasons. I mean, other mergers in the history of HE, but this is the first time in a long time that two medium-sized multi-faculty universities have come together. But it feels like the start of something, doesn't it? Because they talk about the group, they talk about a super university, which I know has been a bit of backlash against on social media. But I wonder if the intention is for there to be more universities themselves, or more providers of education, or more entities that could join this group in the future. And there are a few certainly in the region that, and I don't want to speculate too much, but there are certainly a few that are geographically close to either Kent or Greenwich that have their own challenges and issues and a fairly bleak outlook in terms of finances for the next few years. So wouldn't shock me if those conversations are going to be happening alongside the kind of existing merger. Clearly, merging two universities is extremely complex. Merging four universities is, you know, possible at the same time, possibly unobtainably difficult and raises too many problems. So starting with two makes sense. But I'm fascinated about where this leads, obviously from a policy point of view, also as a Kent graduate. I was involved with the project to work at the Medway site. So Kent, Christchurch and Greenwich worked together at Medway with varying degrees of success, it should be said. And I was a student officer at Kent at the time when we had to come up with a model for a functioning kind of student union, student representative body over in Medway. And it didn't work very well, as far as I can remember. And if you told me then that, you know, one day Kent will, you know, merge with Greenwich, I just wouldn't have believed you, because the contexts are so different. It was felt that these universities are so different, even though I don't think they really are. You know, I think every university likes to think itself as kind of particularly unique and special. It's obviously got each has got kind of distinct characteristics, but yeah, I would have fallen off my chair if you told me that was going to happen. The Medway project, though, you know, ultimately did work, and you know, is a sign that these institutions, you know, can work together on shared delivery and other things, which is good. But yes, what I'm also interested in is, on a sector point of view, then, you know, if this is the first mover, are we going to be thinking about a much more consolidated sector in the future? Fewer universities, fewer large universities. Is it dependent on this working out, or do you think we're about to see an announcement of several more? This is, anyone can pick this up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you've pointed to that sort of, you know, backlash against, you know, the super university term that the team, you know, managing the comms managed to get into lots of the newspaper headlines. You know, but one of the sort of reasons for the backlash is lots of people sort of saying, oh well, you know, by European or by American standards, it's not really very super, is it? You know, in terms of size. And you know, it's true that the UK, you know, if we compare to Australia as well, which, you know, I think is often what sort of policymakers are doing, because the HE systems do have quite a lot of similarities. You know, Australian universities are much larger, you know, so I think we could be heading that way, but to some extent there's some, you know, pressure on how this now goes. You know, the point about additional members in the future joining this group, you know, as well as potentially setting up other ones in other regions, I think is certainly, you know, it's been presented in those terms. There's conversations behind the scenes in those terms. I'm sure the universities have, you know, have publicly said they were quoted in the Telegraph saying, you know, that this new partnership would allow others to join in the future. You know, so it's certainly something that they are thinking about, and they do have this sort of first mover advantage, you know, for the universities who get in on the ground floor, as it was. You know, it's probably, for all the difficulties and all the problems, it's probably easier to do the initial join up, or, you know, sort of less painful organizationally than to later need to come in and join the group. I mean, you would probably have to give up your VC. You'd have to, you know, adopt the services and the processes and all these things that, you know, that the new merger will settle on. You know, so it's, you know, in some ways there's that sort of first mover advantage, which, you know, I think will be sort of setting some hairs running now.
I think that mergers, partnerships, collaborations are absolutely going to be a core competency for universities moving forward. And I think there's a bit of a challenge in that, to some extent, those skills haven't necessarily existed within the sector. And so we've had to kind of be quite dependent on the support of private equity companies and similar organizations who have those skills in abundance. And I'd like us not to be too dependent on those private equity companies. I'd like institutions and their communities to be able to dream up and design the structures and the partnerships and the collaborations that will work for them. I'm not rejecting the role of private companies, but I'd like it to be owned a little bit more in house. And I think there is, you know, again, you know, thinking about my role with AHUA, you know, we are thinking about how do we create the investment into those core competencies in chief operating officers, registrars, so that they have the credibility, the skills, the capabilities, the networks, the informations, so that they can be change makers rather than the people who, you know, sign the bill for the private equity company to send in their guy who's designed a million of these, right? And I think we can either respond to the narrative, because as you've already cited, you know, there's been a certain kind of level of government expectation that universities should be moving and changing more rapidly, given what, you know, what's going on in the world around us. That, you know, there's been ministers who've talked about the rationale for less universities. Let's own this a little bit. Let's build our own competencies. Let's design the solutions. I mean, Emma made the point about kind of students' perspectives and needs, and I do think that is one of the particular, quite specific competencies we'll have to think about, is how do we take students with us on a journey that think about the kind of the art of the possible with student services and student experience and their needs. I fear because they're a kind of fairly transient population that they might get forgotten about, deprioritized, or left behind. And actually, I think there'll be something quite powerful about if we can kind of really build them into the vision piece. Because actually, we know that there are things that frustrate and students or hold them back or barriers that exist in front of them. We might be able to tackle some of that with this, right? As we build new structures, regardless of whether we're calling them super or not, we can find ways to respond to some of the frustrations that the current generation and previous generations of students have experienced.
I think just as well on that, there's some massive scope here. You know, I think it's super university, again, if we're going to use it, that term, is going to be the biggest recruiter of students in London and the Southeast. That's such a large proportion of students in the UK, and a whole load of students in a single region, where if it doesn't work, that's actually going to have quite a detrimental impact, you know, to the area. So it's really important that it's we can get it as right as we can, but also that there's so much opportunity here. So, you know, that sizable presence in a region could give some really considerable weight to develop shared services further. For example, like it might offer, you know, the staff capacity to be able to really consider in that area, like an NHS-HE partnership model that's already demonstrated in places like Wales, Manchester, Liverpool, collaboration with businesses in relation to careers, employability and graduate opportunities, given that it's such a large population of students. I think I'm really interested to see where it goes. I think there's lots of scope. No one likes change. Like, change isn't nice. We often don't like it. We're suspicious of it. But it's how we go about making the change that will make the difference. And I think it's interesting that Professor Peck said, you know, he's been quoted as saying regulatory decisions will be considered carefully and on their merits. And I think lots of people are watching, and it will be interesting to see kind of whether or not much leeway from regulation, whether it's REF, TEF, NSS results is given that things could get a bit wobbly, for want of a better word, during this period, and how government OFS respond to this. People will be watching to see if it's worth the risk.
You mentioned kind of the scale. I think it's a really, really important angle here, and it's also, you would hope, I'm guessing, that it would create some efficiencies in terms of buying power. A bigger university should be able to have more clout. And again, this is another reason why the government likes this, because ultimately you'd hope to save money in the long run. Although there will be significant setup costs, won't there, Michael? I mean, we've not really talked about it, but research is definitely one of the other interesting angles here. You know, are we looking at, presumably we're going to be looking at you know, one single ref submission, you know, one single research institution in that respect. And that kind of rebalances the landscape a bit as well, doesn't it? We're talking about a much bigger, potentially a much bigger, you know, university that does research we didn't have before. And there's all sorts of interesting collaborations and efficiencies and all sorts of things that are can be sparked from bringing all those together under one roof.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, I'm skeptical of some of the things around, you know, efficiency, especially as you mentioned, the sort of the need to invest to bring them off. But I think probably, you know, sharing things like sharing facilities and, you know, that sort of thing is an area that can be, you know, where things can be done. Although, you know, universities do this already. And the other thing to be looking at, and, you know, if you look at the article that we published on Wednesday morning, you know, you can sort of see how the portfolios are sort of split in different areas. There's overlap in some, but there's also a sort of complementariness. I mean, yeah, the questions around what happens with the university as a sort of, you know, what happens with the university group as a sort of, you know, data point, as it were, you know, whether that's in REF or in NSS, you know, how all these different things work, how degree awarding powers are managed. I mean, these conversations will already be sort of in their initial stages. I mean, you know, Research England has sort of in the past, kind of behind the scenes, shown itself quite strict about, you know, who you are employed by is who you're submitting to. Although, of course, it's sort of, you know, now removing that a little bit with the sort of changes to portability. And, you know, in general, there's just lots of questions about the REF. We don't know, you know, what happens if this university merger is actually finalized during a REF submission period, or not submission period, but the period in scope for REF, whenever that may be, it could potentially change. Yeah, there's all kinds of complicated things. But yeah, in the wider point, I mean, this becoming, you know, a university with a big, powerful research base in lots of areas, that's going to, you know, for better or for worse, that's going to affect things like where it appears in the international league tables, I'm sure is something they're thinking about. You know, that will then have a knock-on effect on international student recruitment. I mean, sort of, you know, say what you want about these, you know, these kind of international rankings. I would tend to say bad things myself, but, you know, they are a big motivator for lots of students. You know, this will be one of the driving concerns. And, you know, going back to your question a long time ago about, you know, success criteria, you know, that will be one of them. They'll be thinking, you know, how are we ranked? You know, first of all, are we able to stay ranked separately? Do we come and be ranked together? And then, you know, where are we?
Earlier on, you kind of speculated about the extent to which the model had been designed to allow room for others to join at later dates. And I think there will be quite a lot of institutions who are thinking about themselves and their future and how they make themselves, how they kind of prepare themselves, not necessarily to climb into that group, if you want, but you know, how would I make myself most attractive to exist in and of my own right, to differentiate myself from this new super university? Or, and ironically, you know, maybe these are the same things, but or how would I make myself as attractive as possible so that my bargaining position is strong when I want to climb on board with the super university? And so there's something in there about, you know, I think longitudinally, they might want to think about particular specialisms that don't exist within the partnership. In some ways, if I run a really, really niche, small institution, I don't know, somewhere in that region that's, I don't know, got a really, really strong vocational pedigree or has an unusual set of teaching facilities because I deliver really specific, I don't know, theatre courses or God knows what, you know, that would allow me to have a conversation with the newly merged regional super university and say, here's what I bring that you don't have. I'm bringing something new to the game that broadens your portfolio or addresses a deficit that you had in your league table rankings, as just mentioned. You know, so I do think there will be institutions thinking about how do I respond to this, not necessarily preparing to climb on board, but thinking about what am I great at that is different, because either it could, you know, I can find a way for it to exist in its own right, or I want to go and have it as a strength of proposition for me to join the group.
I just want to bring in something around, which is kind of linked to Ben's point there around like belonging, because I think if I'm thinking about it from student and staff experience, we know sense of belonging is really important for students. And we know that that's a substantial research in this area that's been demonstrated on the site over the last 4 years around sense of belonging and directly linking that to successful outcomes for students, linking back to things like league tables, etc. And so one of the knotty problems here is how you go about creating a sense of belonging to an institution when the institutions themselves are going to be in the process of developing a new collective identity, and also balancing that alongside what the joint statement from Greenwich and Kent refers to as a culture that celebrates individuality, which is going back to Ben's point there. I think thinking about how you kind of marry those things is going to be really tricky in a way that feels authentic to students and staff. And, you know, going back to what you said, Mark, about being a previous University of Kent student, like asking alumni, student, staff, like what made you feel like you belong to this institution, and what was or is important to you, and what's special about that culture that makes you feel like you belonged? Because I think that will actually hold a lot of keys around how they maintain this individual identity and what makes them within this broader kind of piece and merger that is kind of developing as it goes on.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Paul Ashram from Lancaster University, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the Office for Students' suggestion that in future, tuition fees may be linked to outcomes from the Teaching Excellence Framework. This idea is just as unworkable as it was when it was first made in the government green paper 10 years ago. However, what is much more worrying is that in making this suggestion, it implies that the Office for Students does not understand how the TEF works as a measurement of teaching excellence. It also suggests that the Office for Students either does not care or does not understand the impact it has on the sector when it makes such ill-founded suggestions at a time when so many institutions are facing a financial crisis.
Now there's been a reshuffle in Westminster. Ben, walk us through it, please.
Yeah, depending on your source of information, this was either a far more dramatic reshuffle than was originally intended, thanks to the resignation of Angela Rayner from the Deputy PM role. Or alternatively, some people think it was the reshuffle that Keir had always wanted and planned, enabled by the resignation of the Deputy PM. Regardless of which is true, there's actually much less change than perhaps was anticipated in the cabinet team, with the exception of the Home Office, where there's been a kind of fairly comprehensive clear out. But in terms of other departments, not that much going on, really, particularly for departments relevant to higher education, where the big news perhaps is that Patrick Vallance remains a science minister and continues to kind of pull those research strings. But actually, there's a sub-story more recently, of course, that we now know that the Secretary of State for Education, Bridget Phillipson, has stepped forward for the role of Deputy PM and is currently the front runner in a race that's kind of narrowing fairly dramatically as the deadline for securing the necessary backing hits. And if she were to be successful, that could be a bit of a distraction from the education portfolio that she's held so far. That might necessitate other changes around her in DfE. Look, we don't really know whether the inclination of number 10 not to tinker too much with the education brief symbolises a lack of interest for the sector, or perhaps a sense that they're really, really compelled by the detailed plans that are developing in the run-up to the HE reform paper that's due in the coming months. And nobody quite knows what we learn from this, in my view.
Michael, I guess one of the talking points has been about Shabana Mahmood moving to Home Secretary, my former boss, of course. I've got views about this, probably not for the public domain, but what do you reckon? What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's being presented, and I'm sure it is in reality as a sort of, you know, blue Labour takeover. She's linked to sort of, you know, people like Maurice Glasman, the sort of the right of the party, the sort of immigration skeptics. She's being put in, you know, in optics at least, and probably in reality to sort of move faster than Yvette Cooper was. I mean, you know, for all that within the sector, we see Yvette Cooper as someone who was, you know, very unsympathetic to the plight of the higher education sector and international students. You know, the briefing from number 10 is that she was felt to be, you know, slow to take decisions. You know, so it's in those terms, it's probably, you know, fairly negative, except that, you know, the international students is not a major concern for the Home Office. They're much more focused on small boats and other things like that. I mean, yeah, as you alluded to, she is a former shadow minister for higher education, although that's, you know, more than a decade ago. But yeah, I don't see any reason to think she's going to be sort of out there batting for the sector and the importance of international students. They'll continue to sort of, you know, walk the tightrope between, you know, allowing students in, but also trying to get numbers down and keeping their eyes on post-study work as well. And at some point, getting on with implementing some of the stuff in the immigration white paper.
And I mean, there were briefly hopes that there would be some interesting kind of super growth department or whatever that was going to include skills and HE and everything under DWP. And that didn't seem to happen in the end. And it didn't seem, well, there's been very, very little machinery changes and very little actually heading to DWP. So I'm interested in where this leaves us in terms of policy and what we can expect might change when it comes to LLE. Ben mentioned the white paper. You know, one has to presume that that's going to be further pushed back. Jackie Smith's got, you know, another job now inside DfE, and she was pretty busy already. Sorry, she's in DWP now as well, isn't she? She's a DWP minister. So presumably, Michael, that means she'll be speaking for DWP in the Lords on all sorts of random things that got nothing to do with skills, right?
Yep, it does. It's more sort of, you know, stretching her brief even further. I mean, yeah, we're still not quite sure how the sort of Pat McFadden-led DWP is going to take on the skills brief. It could be something that is a bit of a longer-term project, although it, you know, it doesn't feel like that. It feels more like, you know, he's a big name. He's been put into an important job, and they wanted to give him a bit more of a, you know, a little fillip of, you know, here's an extra thing as well. It doesn't feel like they were, you know, have been. It's kind of come out of nowhere, this idea that, oh yeah, skills should be in DWP, right? We've heard, you know, people say, oh, it should go back into the business department, or things like that. But yeah, you know, there is some quite sort of informed people are saying, oh well, this will surely mean that the apprenticeship levy needs to go over to DWP. I mean, there's been absolutely no indication that will happen. So, you know, this is me scaremongering a bit, but, you know, people do think that, you know, this could be longer term something he'll insist on, and he sort of has the ear of the Prime Minister. Yeah, so we don't really know. And, you know, the other wrinkle there is we should remember that, you know, while skills is devolved, lots of the work of DWP around employment and, you know, most parts of Social Security is not devolved. You know, so really trying to take, you know, sort of skills in a big way over there has potentially all kinds of problems and doesn't seem like an ambition the government has ever expressed. So yeah, it does just seem like it's sort of more complications and as you say, a sort of, you know, split briefs for things rather than big policy changes that have been done with sort of clear intentions of what they want to make happen.
You know, and I tend to be the optimist on these things, but you know, while it's sometimes frustrating that we, you know, might look to government to give us more, you know, financial backing, more of a steer, more direction, more cohesion. And sometimes being in the glare of the headlights and subject to dramatic changes for really bad reasons. I mean, you know, they aren't shaking up the Home Office because it's performing extremely well and everyone in the public is really happy with it, right? So maybe it's good news that they've kind of left, you know, departments relevant and ministers relevant to HE alone, because maybe that signals that we're not being used as the same political football that we might see if we were in the US.
I was thinking about what does this mean for our members, certainly. And to be honest, not much, because, you know, this has come at a time when it's very, I mean, the sector is always busy now. I think people regularly say that there's no such thing as a quiet period in higher education now. But particularly this time in the year, it's so busy that we kind of can't be spending time thinking what ifs right now. Certainly our members are getting on with planning induction weeks, you know, getting ready to induct all the new students around, you know, responding to OFS recent higher education freedom of speech related things, the E6 condition. There's so much going on that I think what might happen is kind of low on the agenda and just getting your head down and in keeping on that track more than anything else.
Yeah, I think there's sort of like, you could just see on Friday afternoon, there was about a couple of hours where people got quite excited that maybe HE would not be in DfE anymore. And I think really what that just tells us is something about, you know, how the higher education sector sort of sees, you know, DfE's lack of action and, you know, the sort of the Department for Education treating universities as big schools. But, you know, really, the reality is just exactly as Emma said, you know, a big upheaval, a new minister, a machinery of government change that really affected HE would have been a recipe for, you know, a lot of chaos and complication at a time where, you know, is there really the capacity to deal with it? You know, I think what the sector needs now is just for the white paper to come out and for some clarity on what the rest of the parliament looks like.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today or find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Ben, Emma and Michael. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.